lovers, my name is John Rossi, and I'm a touring drummer with a passion for all things animal. When I'm on the road, I spend as much time as possible visiting zoos and aquariums. Now, I want to share some sexy stories from those places with you. So get ready to hear all about the love and lust you can find at the zoo. You're tuned in to Rossafari After Dark. Hello there, lovers, and welcome back to another incredible episode of Rossafari After Dark, your opportunity to learn all about the sexy stuff that goes down at the zoo. Don't worry, I'm not going to do this the whole time. This is not another holiday special. But yeah, hey, y'all, it is the day before Valentine's Day. And whether you think that Valentine's Day is the coolest thing in the world or the dumbest thing in the world, well, I think it's a great opportunity to have a fun little episode. And so that is what we are doing this week. My guest is someone who you've heard from a couple times before. It's Maxine Van Dam, and she's going to be coming to us kind of from a different place in life than she had been before. And this is going to be a conversation all about the breeding process at zoos. Now, that's kind of what the idea was, but if y'all remember Maxine, you know that her and I tend to just kind of talk about a lot of stuff. I would say that we get off topic, but I mean, honestly, we usually come in without a topic, so I guess I can't say that. But yeah, this one's a lot of fun. So there are a few slightly, you know, off-color jokes, and we do start off talking about like the SSP and how breeding works from that perspective, and there are some fun and gross animal stories, animal sex stuff, but nothing crazy. Parents, you may want to listen first before you let your kids listen, but like, I don't think there's anything in here that's particularly problematic. Not at all, in fact. So, yeah, it's a really fun chat. And despite all the sexy After Dark music and everything, we also just, you know, talk about things like whether or not facilities should name their animals. And if so, whether facilities should rename animals when they get them from another facility and just stuff like that. There's all kinds of fun things in here, and I'm really excited to share it with you. But before I do that, a couple of quick reminders. Make sure you hit subscribe. Make sure that you don't miss any episodes that way. Make sure you're following along on social media at Rossafari everywhere, except for the TikTok machine where it's at Rossafari Pod. And yeah, I'm excited to have y'all along for the ride. So without further ado, here is my interview. Excuse me, my sexy interview with Maxine Van Dam. Oh, yeah. Is it still sexy if that's kind of just the Kool-Aid guy? Anyway, here's the interview. All right, so let's start off like we always do by you telling me who you are and what you do.
So I'm Maxine Van Dam, and I do visual communications for different conservation organizations and work in grief and animal support spaces.
All right. Nothing sexier than that. We are off to a great start in Rossafari After Dark here. Let's talk about grief. And no, I'm kidding. So we're here to talk about some fun, sexy things dealing with animals and reproduction and all that good kind of stuff. So I guess we should probably start off with the top of the game, so to speak, which is matchmaking. And so, you know, we're here. This is kind of our Valentine's Day episode. And so I'm wondering how that all works out for animals. You know, a lot of my listeners know a little bit about SSPs and stuff, but let's really get into it and talk about Tinder for animals here.
Well, that is a great way to put the SSP program. It is kind of a matchmaking service where there's a lot of science behind it. But essentially, it's to create genetic diversity and safe holding in zoos. And what I really think is extremely valuable about the SSP program is that it changed people's perceptions of zoos. And it was really a great foundation for the purpose that we think of in zoos today, that when we're thinking that that old school zoo, the animals in cages, and a lot of what we still hear from animal rights rhetoric about why do we have animals in zoos. In 1981, when AZA created the SSP plan, it really gave a foundation for many zoos' missions, but also to bring why do we have a zoo? What is the purpose of it? And it's to create a genetic safe holding for these animals that are vulnerable so that they can also be self-sustaining. We don't need to take animals out of the wild, but then we can sustain their populations in a responsible manner and until we can fix and help these spaces where they're not thriving, because a lot of times it's people. People can also be a part of that solution through this matchmaking service, the SSP.
And SSP stands for those who are new to this,
Species Survival Plan.
Yeah, nothing sexier sounding than that.
You know, they should have thought about the app way to, you know, market it a little bit better. But, you know, SSP, it's dated for the terms. We can always bring it up, you know, to how we can have it just be Tinder.
Yeah, exactly. Tinder for animals. I love it. And I guess something that I found interesting when I first got into this world is that, like, not every species has an SSP. And recently I've talked on Zoo News about the fact that it's actually now gotten a little bit harder to be an SSP. So can you talk about some of those changes and how zoos are adapting to them?
Of course, we want to make sure that our vulnerable species, you know, have that reason. Why do we have them? How are we protecting them? But there's a lot of things when it's the logistics of managing that, that we have to be responsible as well. So when we think about, I want to save X species, do we have enough resources? Do we have enough participation? Are there enough individuals to responsibly do this? So recently, there's been a lot of look at which animals we can really do this successfully with and responsibly with. And some have now gone through the process of what I'll call an SSP breakup, where there used to be recommended for a species survival plan, but either because of those resources or maybe overrepresentation in captivity, that now maybe we're not going to continue. I think black-footed cats was one that just from simply, I think you have to have a 16 facility requirement or around there, so that there's enough participation to really do that responsibly. And they're right on the cusp there, so that they weren't recommended for SSP again. Now, does that mean we don't care about these species of animals that have lost? No, not at all. But maybe there's other programs that can facilitate things for their conservation a little bit better. Things like there's been so much attention, which, you know, I'm very biased that I am a big supporter of SAFE for being kind of an alternate way of managing animals where they don't maybe have the requirements for a full-blown SSP, or maybe sometimes SSP, because of the management requirements itself, it's not a good fit. And SAFE is really kind of taking that in a more creative approach, where they're able to work with other organizations and other animal population management groups, so that they can be worked with in a different way that's not as rigid as SSP. Those things are in place for particular reasons, but just like everything, there's a way and then there's other ways. And sometimes one just isn't the best fit. And so I really like that with SAFE. There's been more flexibility for how we can manage animals, but still keep it regulated, still make sure that that incredibly high standard that we see is being fulfilled.
Makes sense. And again, for anybody who doesn't know, what is SAFE?
SAFE is Saving Animals from Extinction. It is an AZA program. I'm also the SAFE Education Advisor for Chinchilla SAFE, for our favorite fuzzy butts over there. So it's a great way for conservation to happen, not only with that captive sense, but how we then support the animals in the locations that they're actually in. So we may have an SSP for an animal, but we also may have a SAFE program for an animal. And that's maybe making sure that the conservation issues on the ground can have some progress moving forward. Or with Chinchilla SAFE, we're really trying to establish what is the population, where is the population, to start those protection processes, so that maybe down the line, if we have a chinchilla SSP and we can do an introduction. There's a place for them to be introduced. There's something that's already put in place so that that can be a successful introduction. And SSP has had many successes, of course. We always talk about black-footed ferrets and our golden tamarins. So there is a lot of success to be had, but that's because of that combination of captive genetic breeding and responsible practices with animal management in captivity in conjunction to a on-the-ground conservation effort that we really need to have partnership between. And that's kind of the link that we're seeing that SAFE is really helping to support. And that these animals also have your actual communities involved. It's not just people in a zoo in North America, you know, coming in and telling people who have lived in their homes with these animals and understand them and having, you know, no voice. And that's something that I love, that SAFE really gives voice to the people who live in those areas. Because again, you can't really have successful conservation without people. And yeah. It's a lot of times a focus on animals. Of course, we love them. But without the people element there, it's not successful. We have to have those local communities be just as involved and invested in that protection as some outsider coming in who is really passionate about their, you know, rare species of, you know, XYZ. That's wonderful. Have that love, have that passion. But have that relationship too. Have that space of openness and vulnerability to have conversations, really understand how do we sustain this? How do we support people to be able to continue to protect these animals? And that it's messy, you know, it's not one way, one answer. So when we see SAFE, it's one answer to a set of issues that we can then create more of a dialogue, create more funding for, you know, this type of program. And then with SSP, it's taking that other step. And I think that having a bigger acceptance of that, we need to have mess. We need to have conversations, and it needs to be not, this is the way. This is what we're doing. It's all about relationship building, which I'm going to then, you know, bring it back to our topic today, which is kind of animal relationships. And it takes a lot of relationships between people and animals to really have successful conservation.
Absolutely. And I think it's fascinating, the kind of the transition. Like you said, SAFE is a newer program and is becoming bigger every year right now. And I know there's like, you know, there are people pushing to start a Red Panda SAFE. But the Red Panda SSP is like, well, wait a minute, guys, we already work with Red Panda Network to do the conservation on the ground, and they already have the relationships. Like, do we need a SAFE? Not in a bad way, but just in a like, do we need? And there's all this like fun little, you know, figuring out how all this stuff goes together, which I find to be absolutely fascinating. You know,
I think Red Panda is, of course, a great example because it's one of the SSPs that for me does operate more like a SAFE program. And that's kind of where SSP is, I think, where it sees its strengths and sees its weaknesses, that maybe if there was more of a traditional SSP, that then it'd be like, yes, we do need SAFE, but that one's such a robust SSP that it's kind of operating like a dual program there, which is why it has so much success. And it also has so much support, and people know about it, and people have that feel and that buy-in for this program, whereas some of the other SSPs maybe don't have that as much, but their SAFE program is really gaining that.
No, absolutely. I think that's really cool. And yeah, I remember when I met Sarah Glass and then she agreed to be on the podcast early on, I felt like I was meeting a celebrity, which is just shows how much of a dork I am. But I mean, it was cool.
No, you're totally on the same ground here. definitely. I think when you meet the people that are doing that work and bringing those communities together, They do have this type of like, oh my gosh, I'm meeting this person who's been able to pull this together and to gain that support. And so I think she deserves that celebrity status because she's really making a difference in connecting people to animals. And that takes a mindset and an openness. And a lot of it is because of those relationships with those partners through Red Panda Network on the ground, that you can really understand, this is why we're doing this. Okay, it's not just so, you know, we love SSP because, let's be honest, the baby red pandas.
Babies,
you can't
good.
Get any better than baby animals. But also that, okay, this is also having a direct effect to that area where that animal is from and that community where those people live and work with those animals. And that's remarkable. So she's totally up there.
Absolutely. All right. So now that we've established the least sexy part of the conversation, I thought we could get into some of the more individual stories that you have that you can share from your career, because you've worked at some different facilities and with a bunch of different animals, and have been kind enough to share some of those animals and some time with me, which I appreciate. So I'm curious if you would be able to share some stories, some breeding stories about maybe when the SSPs at an individual level get a little unique.
Yes, and I've worked at AZA facilities with AZA-based SSPs. I've also worked with breeding programs just so that we have that, you know, genetic sustainability without having to go into the wild. So I think some of the best examples I have are from those vulnerable species. And let's be honest, birds are bonkers. They, you know, if anyone around Valentine's Day is like, sheesh, you know, I have to go get some flowers, some chocolate, just thank whoever you need to that you are not a bird. That I think we could probably do a whole podcast just on the weird mating habits of birds and their love lives. But just from being in a program of breeding different hornbills and softbills, I have to talk about my most prolific animal I've ever met when it comes to he was going to save the whole species on his own. I worked with a breeding group of channelbill toucans. So a smaller toucan, beautiful, noisy as all get out, of course. We have to have that involved. But for a long time, we were not having any success at my facility. That we had, I think, six different mating groups. You know, you have your two females, your male. We tried to do a couple different combinations, big free flight spaces. And then we got this male in, and he didn't have a name. Some facilities, of course, we have individual names for, and some, and you know, this is male of group B, male of group C. But this animal earned his name, respectively, because he was incredibly prolific. The moment that he got in there, clutches started to appear. And then we had it where, you know, the females, we were trying to see would they, you know, sit on nest themselves. They were not really too invested with the whole mother idea. So we were then, you know, pulling and putting in incubators. The moment those eggs were gone, they had eggs again. We're like, oh, this is, oh my goodness. Okay. Have you had enough break there, mama? Are you doing okay? Check in, do all their health checkups. But that our male ended up getting the name Viagra.
Nice.
Because he was extremely prolific. The minute he could be in there, I mean, we had no success for years. Viagra got in there and we had the whole population of channel. I think we had the most channel bills in captive, like holding. I couldn't find any place else that had more than us. I was like, okay, now at this point, you're overrepresented in captivity. So we had to, you know, take Viagra away, essentially. And we put him in a group that where he could still have his enjoyment, but that there wouldn't be any eggs. But that he was probably one of the most successful breeding stories I've ever encountered, to the fact where we had to maintain that health of the female population that we had. And then on the other hand, I've had some that are, you know, not as successful. I know that we've all in the zoo community been like so excited that, oh, like we have an SSP for, you know, this animal here and we're going to have babies. And then sometimes it just doesn't happen. We have those animals where, you know, in keeper world, just like, are you missing? Like, what is happening here? You know, do we need to have like an instructional diagram for those who, you know, understand the giant panda world? Do we need to make some movies for you? Like, what do you need to get into the mood here? But sometimes it's because their hearts are already taken. And unfortunately, sometimes they can be taken by us keepers.
I mean, to be fair, you are a bit of a flirt. I'm just saying. So, like, are you sure this isn't your fault when this knock?
I mean, I am a bird nerd and a bird lover, but I do respect the boundaries between, you know, animal and human relationships in that regard. I'm going to make that clear for everyone in the community. Yes, I don't cross the line in case, you know, I ever need to work with you in the future. Disclaimer. But
I just broke your brain a little bit. You did not see that coming.
I did not. But I like to be thrown off my feet a little bit. But let's, you know, not go down that trail.
Fair. Yeah.
But I did work with a hornbill, a southern ground hornbill, who was incredibly infatuated with the human staff a lot more than his bird that was brought in. We had two different females that we brought in, and he kind of got the idea with the hornbill breeding, you know, you're going to be a little bit, you know, pushing the female on the ground, getting on there. He did the pushing on the ground and like, let me prove to you, keeper, that, you know, I don't care about her. Let me shove her in the water bowl or wherever I need to go. You're here. Like, just where we had to figure out a way, essentially, where before we had the females, this was a hand-raised hornbill. There's a lot of relationship building. There was a lot of training involved, so that there was a great relationship there from keeper and animal standpoint. But how do you break up with the bird so that they can fulfill their SSP? What's that process like where you're not going to then, you know, also, you know, create a lot of distress for an animal where this is their normal, that you're almost, you know, that complex enrichment item? How do you kind of step aside from that and allow, you know, that ability to maybe fulfill their breeding program in a way that isn't distressing to them either? So it took a lot of literally moving to a different area of the facility, creating a new way of introducing the females. And, you know, with southern ground hornbills, their success rate is like maybe you're getting your clutch of like 2 to 3 eggs every 6 years. So it was a long and slow breakup. But there still hasn't been success. I check it every now and then. I'm like, hey, how has he been? You know, we all want to maybe, you know, see.
So wait a minute. What you're telling me is that you stalk your ex on social media every once in a while. Is that what you're telling me right now? It's a bird, but you stalk your ex on social media.
I ask the keepers that care for them now. It's kind of like the friend of a friend. Like,
right, yeah.
Hey, I used to work at this facility with this animal. How are they doing? Are they doing okay without me? But there is there's a lot of investment for the species, but also I hope that eventually for that captive space and that long-term care and thinking about individual welfare, that animal is thriving as well. Because with these type of programs, of course, you're thinking about the big picture and logistics, but at a certain point, you really are bringing it down to the animal's welfare, care, and compatibility. Sometimes, you know, I'm sure we have animals like those, you know, are they getting what's happening? Why isn't it being successful? Is it a compatibility of those two individuals? I kind of like people to understand if they're asking, why haven't this animal had a baby yet? I'm like, well, think about it. You have, you know, a couple, maybe dozen to 100 of this species. Somebody is like, these ones look really genetically, you know, compatible. You get there and the other animal is just so annoying or just a jerk or gosh, they're boring. Like, are they going to like do this behavior every day? They really care about targeting. Like, come on, guy. Like, you got to imagine, you know, the everyday life of this animal. And of course, you know, triggering anthropomorphism for this whole episode warning here. But that you also have to think about the individual animals, and some animals just aren't successful. At my last zoo, we had our Amur leopards, and we know that we had a lot of success with the previous male that was with our female. And then that male has gone to another facility and that's not been successful. Now, is that because he was in love with Jade? And, you know, there was this deep bond and romance. Maybe. But it also just could be that there's a lot of other compatibility issues, you know, with whichever animals they're paired with. So with SSP, there's a certain amount of, you know, big picture that we can think about. But at the end of the day, we're all individuals. We all have these relationships. And as much science and thought and care that we put into the program, sometimes it will or will not be successful. And that's also something that is struggling for us to understand when we're like, don't you understand? You're one of the last 100 of this species. Just do it. Literally, just do it. But there's the individuals of the species that are also what we connect with in captivity themselves. We don't just know, oh, yeah, that's that species leopard. Boop, check. It's like, oh, I know this animal. Mm-hmm. And so even when we have an animal who's maybe not fulfilling our SSP as we would hope and plan, I'm still hopeful that at least, you know, we're fulfilling a different thing with their purpose of their life in captivity, which is that connection with people to understand this individual's animal's needs, their care, why there is an SSP. You know, maybe they need the hope of the public to do it. But that there's still a lot of value in why we have captive conservation efforts.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, it's funny you mentioned the bird thing. And one of the stories that I have heard from a bird keeper is that at Southwick's Zoo, there is a bird who is really fickle and who always likes the new girl. Whenever there's a new girl, he will literally like change his behaviors towards the last new girl and become infinitely easier to work with and train with and stuff, but then just spend all his time whenever he's around the new girl flirting. And that will last right until there's another new girl. And I was like, I know some guys like that. I do, you know, it's like, yeah, like again, anthropomorphizing, but literally like I know guys who can't be in serious relationships that I am friends with because like they start dating someone and then like another pretty girl walks by and, you know, it's that meme of the girl looking over her shoulder only, you know, in a reverse in this case. But yeah, I find stories like that so fascinating.
I definitely think that they need to get a really good rotational intern program there for that bird. Just always somebody, you know, in that 3-month internship program.
I love the idea of going back to the bird that you were talking about too. Like, oh man, it's like well, you know, a work relationship. Because you still like you're still training the bird, you're still working with the bird, you still have to provide husbandry for that bird. Can you maybe talk a little bit about some of the steps? I know you kind of very vaguely dig, but can you talk about some of the steps in more detail that you guys took to break up but keep a cordial working relationship?
This is a PSA not to date your coworkers. A lot of it was, okay, let's start to have it be where you're scheduled. Maybe you're working that section on one day, but then you're working in a different section or with a different animal. So they're not then having that immediate, like, where'd they go? But that then you have someone else working with them and then having that rotation be a little bit higher. So maybe instead of having one consistent keeper on that routine, that you're going to have a couple different keepers on that routine. Then also, is this a bird that because of their really strong, you know, relationship with just humans in general, is this one that we need to have as an exhibit animal or an off exhibit animal? So for his case, we actually put an off exhibit holding for a long time. And that we then were saying, okay, is he getting enough enrichment? Is he getting enough stimulation? So he had a heightened kind of enrichment routine and an off exhibit with more rotational keepers. Now, he still hasn't been successful, but these are steps that we can take so that we don't cause, of course, distress to the individual animal. But then we can kind of do a nice, slow, easy breakup for them in a way. But animals are very, when they're in that captive context, it is hard to not anthropomorphize. And it is hard not to see it as a relationship that you're going in and establishing and building every single day. I think that that's a pro to be able to do that in a responsible manner and then understand, because when we have relationships and it's not just a representation of a larger group, we're going to do a different type of care. And I find that a lot of the zookeepers that I have learned the most from and that I see are doing just incredible work and have so much respect for are those that have these relationships with these animals. And they don't, it's not, of course, zookeeping's not, it's not a job that you just, you go and then you're off work. And that can be really tricky for a lot of, you know, your own work-life balance, your own mental health spaces, your own, you know, trying to find what is your lifestyle? What, how do you do this? But that also you're able then to have this be a little bit more of a purpose-based work environment, a purpose-based lifestyle. And that a lot of the times those strengths are what build into those relationships that aren't just, I'm saving this species. It's that I've created a deep-seated bond with this individual animal, their personalities, their quirks. I understand them, and that helps me to understand the importance of what I'm doing beyond just the extrinsic, you know, job or the intrinsic, I just need to save species. Relationships are what make the world just kind of function healthily. But you have to then maintain healthy relationship practices too.
Yes. Again, no dating coworkers. Just the. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Very cool. No, that makes a lot of sense. And I think, you know, I've talked about this on here before, but anthropomorphism is a problem in some regards. And when you take it too far, it is. But I also think sometimes people are so worried about anthropomorphism that they miss the fact that there are relationships with these animals and that there are behaviors that these animals can do. Like, I don't know, an easy example is I've literally heard people say that you shouldn't say what an animal's favorite food is. It's anthropomorphism. It's not. If there is an animal that will come running for one type of food and not for another type of food, it's their favorite type of food. They wouldn't use the word favorite because they don't speak English, but that's what it is. And I've heard a lot of that kind of stuff get kind of castigated as anthropomorphism in a bad way, when really I think not only is that important to, like you said, building that relationship, building trust, understanding it, you're going to use that for training. Training is the study of one individual, you know, and how to work with them. But beyond that, when you communicate that to people, that's what people fall in love with. You know, it's not, I don't fall in love with Red Panda number 312247. I fall in love when you toss a name on it and tell me that this little goober will not eat biscuits and just waits for the fresh bamboo. And if the bamboo's ever not fresh, then they're not going to eat it and they're going to give you a look. And that look, you know, again, are we anthropomorphizing when we say they're giving you a look? If every time they get not fresh bamboo, they make a face at you, maybe that's just what's happening. I don't know. There's a weird line, and I think it's okay to use it to a point. But then at some point, it's like, oh, okay, let's not put the chimpanzee in a tuxedo, you know.
And with anthropomorphizing, it's a way to build empathy. And empathy is such an incredibly powerful tool. And a lot of the times it's one of the few tools that we do have to help protect species that aren't as cute as red pandas. When you have to care about a prehensile tailed skink, for example, how are you telling me the steps to fall in love with a skink? And a lot of that is to then start to understand their behavior and then how we relate that to our own behavior. So it could be used as something really positive, and it can be used as something negative. It takes a little bit of empathy and a little bit of understanding of those animals themselves. So with a like skink, for example, they don't have the physical muscles to be able to smile and frown. Do we think that they're happy? Do we think that we're sad? Can we use emotions when you're using, like, you know, they wouldn't call it their favorite food. Maybe emotion isn't the exact perfect term, but we don't have an analogous term for that.
Right, right.
Can animals themselves have empathy? What can they feel? So we have to sometimes use our own human language to describe things that we see, physiological, you know, experiences that are similar to ours. You know, when we're anxious, we have our temperature go up and our heart rate, you know, increase. we're seeing something similar. We're going to use this human word for that, but then we can understand. But that their emotion, does that then make it where it could be harmful? I think the easiest thing to say harmful is when you see a lion sleeping and you hear the family that comes by and says, "Oh, he's so sad." Is that lion sad, or is that natural behavior of a lion to be sleeping in the middle of the day?
Right, yeah.
So we can use this to understand, oh, well, I think that this snake is really, you know, happy because he's not in a ball when he's a ball python. And even though I can't see him smile or frown because of the muscles in his face, I understand their behavior may mean this feeling. And now I can understand them a little bit more from a human to a reptile. And that makes me care a bit more. That's really positive anthropomorphism.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that combo.
No, yeah, it's an interesting line. I found, you know, one of the things that I do a lot when I'm at a facility is if I hear people talking, like you said, I will pipe up if I feel like it and if I'm reading the room and it seems like an appropriate thing. But like, you know, like you said, if somebody said, oh, that lion's sad, it's sleeping in the middle of the day, I would pipe up and go, oh, yeah, actually, lions sleep in the middle of the day. If we were in Africa right now, you'd see the same behavior, you know, only there'd be a lot more scars on the body and stuff because life is harder out there. One thing that I found is with talking to people about sea turtles, because sea turtles are a solitary species. They do not have a happy looking face. They don't smile like you were saying with skinks, you know. And I've heard a lot of people at aquariums over the years be like, oh, look at that sea turtle. It's so sad. It's all alone. And if I say, well, actually, sea turtles are a solitary species, and so that's kind of what they, you know, are used to and what they would prefer. It doesn't always land as well as if I say, actually, sea turtles like being alone. They're kind of like that grumpy friend that we all have who likes to, like, not go to parties and stuff. They're just not very social. They're the kind of antisocial. Now, is that anthropomorphizing? Yeah, it is. Antisocial is a weird phrase to use for a sea turtle, but it gets them more engaged. And as opposed to them looking and being like, solitary species, I'm a science nerd, it's something they can connect with, and it does make a difference. So, yeah, I think it's an interesting line for sure. You know,
and I think that that's something that when we're looking carefully at the language that we use around animals, like, do we don't want to use this is their favorite food. We don't want to use this because we want to be the most accurate possible for the animal. Again, that's then taking away the fact that we need relationships between animals and people to make conservation happen. So for me, I'm always going to lean on the side. If you have an 8-year-old kid who's at the zoo and they're saying like, oh, this animal, he's, you know, he's being funny, he's being silly, he's doing this. I'm not going to take that excitement, that energy, that connection that they're feeling. Or, you know, when we have an animal, my last facility, we had a giraffe that if you were wearing a black polo like every employee, that giraffe is going to come up and they're going to think that you have food. But this experience, I brought a friend, they're wearing the black polo, and they had a moment. Was that moment happening for the giraffe? Probably not. The giraffe was just like, the moment for him was like, this keeper came up to me and didn't even have a snack. How dare they? But that moment for that person was, I had this amazing experience, this incredible thing between me and an animal. And that person came afterwards from that experience and looked up information on the giraffe. To take them from just standing in an exhibit to doing an action item, that's powerful. Mm-hmm. So while it can be used in a negative fashion, I'm always going to lean on the side of whatever builds connection is going to make a bigger impact than having a closed conversation of, well, actually, you know, this is this. Also, sometimes it shuts people out from asking further questions. It's them saying, like, you're wrong. People don't like being told they're wrong, but being like, oh, like, do you know this type of behavior, this type of thing? If you can get someone to be like, yes, kind of, it's an opening for them to then have further questions. And then you can say, you know, actually, at that point, this is what they do in the wild. that you have to establish a relationship first to be able to have that happen naturally.
No, yeah. And like in the story that you gave, that's a parasocial relationship, like a one-way relationship, but it's very real. You know, you share that story, but like that's also my story. There was a red panda that did not know that I existed, who I went and visited at the Philly Zoo almost every day. And I don't know why I fell in love with her in particular. She wasn't even the first red panda at that zoo. They had two exhibits at the time, and she was in the second exhibit. But something about her made me fall in love with her. And that's when I started doing more research into red pandas. And that's when I started talking to zookeepers more, because I wanted to learn about her, which led to me starting to talk to other zookeepers, which led to me starting Raw Safari. And now, like, not only this entire journey that I'm on, but the thousands of dollars we've raised for conservation and the, you know, hundreds of thousands of downloads of this information that has been shared with people and stuff, all came from that parasocial relationship. And yeah, so they really do have a powerful impact. And I do think you're right that getting rid of that kind of thing, you know, can be problematic, while at the same time you can't go too far with it. It's definitely a balance. But yeah, I'm like the ultimate example of that, as I'm here in my red panda hoodie and my red panda t-shirt underneath and my penguin pants that I'm wearing right now. Like, all of that comes from falling in love with these animals, you know, and the more educated that I get, I still also have those relationships and love those animals. So,
and that is, when you talk about the power of love, that's the power of love for animals and how much change has been able to happen. So continue building those relationships. And I would encourage other keepers, and especially like education departments, to have those conversations about communication, so that we can understand, maybe from a behavioral standpoint, what they're maybe communicating, but build those relationships, build those open spaces for these conversations to happen, because you don't know which of, you know, the kids in that class are going to become the next John and continue the work of the red panda enthusiast and conservation supporter and community builder.
And going along with that, just as a personal, I'm kind of curious of your opinion on this, because one thing that I've talked to a couple of zoos about, and some have actually changed and some have kind of looked at me askance like I'm an idiot, but is some zoos, and it's very few, but some zoos have started putting quotation marks around their animal names in like social media posts and stuff. So they'll be like, you know, this polar bear, Fozzie, with quotes around the name, does this or thinks this. Well, not thinks this, I wouldn't say that, but you know, whatever. And I think that is such a mistake, because we connect with names, and to be like, oh, lol, this is the name that we call it, but it's not a real thing, takes away from that relationship, especially when, honestly, a lot of times it's animals that do learn their names and will come when called and stuff. And you could debate whether they know that's their name or whether they think that's their cue to come or whatever. But like, there is some understanding that in that case, you know, Fozzie means something to that animal. So, yeah, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, but that bugs me.
I definitely do. Again, this seems like, let me put this aside. Let me close this off. Those quotations literally separate whatever that post is away from the rest of the connecting piece. And when we were, there's a big conversation, especially with the ambassador animals, animals that you could have a more like even intense close up interaction with it. Should they have names? Should they not have names? You connect more with names. So I'm on the side of connection. I'm on the side of build those relationships with animals. I don't like personally to separate that and to keep it cold and clinical. And also from just my own personal philosophy around animals and understanding of relationship building, that when we break it down almost to a, this is Latin name, this is number, it's really also a patriarchal approach to animals, which is exclusive. A lot of the times, the way that we're interacting with animals, we need that signs, we need things, but that we can also have, when we're looking at kind of, you know, masculine and feminine traits, considering like, oh, it's a soft approach to have empathy in this type of language with an animal. This is science. This is important. This is conservation. It's almost used again as another way to close off relationships, communities, and groups. And that's something that doesn't rub me the right way. I want things to be as open, inclusive. I want to have communities. I want to have conversations. And putting something in quotation marks, just if you read it out loud and you put that gesture, it means something different. If I say, you know, this person's nice in quotation marks, you read it like that instead of saying this person's nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Every time I've seen it. And when I read the post, like that's what my brain does. It literally, you know, like what I said, it's not like this polar bear, Fozzie. This polar bear, Fozzie, like dummies call it Fozzie. And it actually makes me feel like disconnected. Exactly what you said. So I think, yeah, okay. I was just curious. I didn't plan on bringing that up in this episode, but it does definitely fit the overall conversation that we're having. So, yeah, that makes sense. But I do want to take it back to at least one more kind of fun, sexy story of silly breeding that you have. So, well, not that you have, but that the animals have. So.
That's a different podcast, Josh.
Oh, that's an entire, we could do an entire, as people who are friends and have even hung out outside of the animal world a little bit, we could do an entire podcast about you.
Why, thank you, I think.
Max
put that in quotation marks. Yeah,
that one's going in quotation marks. No, but so tell me another fun story.
So I kind of was thinking before being on the show today, what are some of the weirdest breeding animals or courtship habits? And porcupines, man.
Really?
Porcupines have a disgusting courtship relationship. It's foul. It's... I've worked with breeding pairs of prehensile tail porcupines, the Brazilian porcupine. I at first didn't know this is just these individuals. Is this species? What's going on? But as a caretaker, the smells, I know any porcupine keepers here, you probably are smelling them now just to the mention of the word porcupine. For the public that doesn't have the privilege of sniffing porcupines, they smell like a combination of like a locker room and like just mold. It's so intense and bad that at the facility I had, it was a really nice indoor exhibit. But because of the smell, people would sometimes be like, what's wrong with this place? And it was just their natural smell. But they were also a breeding group. And basically, once a year, the females can breed for like a window between 8 to 12 hours. That's it.
Wow.
And they produce a smell that calls. They're like, it's the 8 to 12 hours. Get in line, guys. Like, this is time. Now or never. And so they produce a mucus that is just B.O. rotten egg, foul, foul, foul scent. But even worse, I mean, once a male finds their lovely lady by the scent, just stench, awful stench, their way of reciprocating is to have projectile concentrated urine and just to pee all over her. So if you have to deal with breeding porcupines, first, you know, oh God, it's time. You smell the female. You prepare. Then the males start. Like, and I mean, it's not like a normal, like we're tinkling. This is spray, like fire hose, like dark, stinky porcupine pee all over her. And she loves it. And then if she accepts the male, then she won't let the male stop copulating until they're almost passed out of exhaustion. Because again, only 8 to 12 hours. And then once that porcupine is exhausted, she just goes to the next one if there's one available. Until that hours of, or that window between 8 to 12 is closed, the year has been successful, and then hopefully you have a cute baby porcupine. And of course, if it's a prehensile-tailed or Brazilian porcupine, they're some of the cutest babies. They come out like orange. They look like a fuzzy Cheeto with a rat tail. It sounds weird, but it's so cute. And it's worth the smell. For the sight, at least, of what comes later. But I think in and witnessing and smelling, that's probably the strangest courtship behavior that I've ever experienced in the zoological field. There's definitely that wooing in the zoo is just remarkable.
See, and this is the difference. This is the difference between you and me. You say wooing in the zoo is remarkable. And my brain's going, all right, so we go stank to golden shower to exhaustive copulation to polyamory. Okay. All right.
We can learn a lot from animals about all different types of relationships and how they make it work.
I mean, we do not kink shame on this podcast. So, you know, whatever. I'm sure that you can find every one of those things that we just talked about. Humans doing it on the internet. I guarantee you there is a Reddit subgroup somewhere talking about every one of those things.
Hashtag porcupine is going to be a dangerous zone after this airs.
Oh, well, my goodness. Oh, that
no,
is
I have to make a bad pun.
Go for it.
Maybe the only ones that we can kink shame is the kink of juice.
Oh.
I'm so sorry.
I like that so much.
So, but yeah, I would say porcupines are top.
That's
it comes
rough.
To bad courtship. Again, if you're complaining about what you have to do for Valentine's Day and your obligations and your relationships, you're not a porcupine.
So are there any other ones that are particularly standing out to you as icky?
I think also maybe this is just my own thing, but giraffes are also weird. They drink the female's pee to see if they're fertile before they copulate. So
who amongst us has? I mean, what?
I actually, before I knew this, it was really in the dark ages of my career when I was a little tiny intern at the Riverbank Zoo and Garden, and they had kind of like a hidden little area close to the giraffes where I would have my lunch and kind of sit there like taking my break. And then I saw just the giraffes drinking each other's pee. And I was like, what is happening? Like, I thought it was just like, there's something wrong. Are they giving them enough water? Like, I mean, early on in the career, I was concerned.
Fair.
And of course, as we know, giraffe people, then of course the giraffe people probably call somebody, you know, write a letter to the facility, go beyond, get on the Facebook page. But I did, that's where I learned that, you know, well, they're testing if they're fertile or not. They can actually sometimes taste if they're on birth control or not as well. So that's a thing that I also think is just weird, but it's fascinating too. And then you have to think, so does this SSP for giraffe have to look for flavorless birth control? Like, where do we go from here? And that's the doors that open so that you have to have relationships now with your coworkers to talk about the flavor of giraffe pee.
Yeah, that is a really interesting. That is really interesting. Yeah, no. And I think it's also interesting because, like, you know, here in the States, we use a lot of birth control. In other places, including in like European zoos and stuff, they won't do that. They let them breed naturally and just cull the population. And to me, that sounds very cruel, but there are arguments for it, including that, you know, reproducing is a natural part of the life cycle of a lot of these animals. And a lot of them don't keep their young with them. So it's not like culling will like make the mommy be like, oh, I miss my baby. I get all of that. But yeah, I don't know. It's definitely interesting to think about those differences. And it becomes a really nuanced conversation when you're like, oh, but now giraffe can taste birth control in the urine they drink. Like, it's funny, but it's also really worth considering, you know, because then maybe a giraffe on birth control won't get the mating behavior. And maybe they want that. Some species do that behavior for reasons other than copulation or for, you know, birthing, and some don't. And it goes into some wildly interesting nuances when you really get into it, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of that zoom in, zoom out, where you're looking at those individual animal relationships to the logistics and, you know, when a program is, you know, how we look at an SSP. A lot of people be like, how do you mean you have an SSP for this animal if, you know, we're culling them? Well, what are our resources? can we do this responsibly? And so again, we're in this space where we have to kind of hold these two sometimes opposing, you know, feelings in ourselves to help. And that's again, where do we put our empathy? How do we have a way to floodgate and you know, siphon the strength of these things? It's so tricky. And that's also why conversation is so important in relationships between people and animals. Our conversations between different ideas of how to care for them in captivity, us in the conservation and zoological fields, how do we have these conversations with each other as well? I think a lot of things to consider too is when we're speaking out loud in these environments and we say kind of like, oh, well, we shouldn't anthropomorphize, we shouldn't empathize, we shouldn't do this, this is, you know, this way. What voices are you also then shutting out from your own, maybe, you know, coworkers that you can learn from different perspectives? That, again, conversations then are going to change the way that the course of conservation, especially in captivity, really looks. And I'm really enjoying conversations that I'm hearing from newer zookeepers and interns that are coming in and kind of shaking this up in certain ways. And then how the responses are and how we build with the mind of what is the future. I think it's incredibly valuable and important. So relationship building between animals, between people, I think that's the theme.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, I mean, that's one thing I've been intrigued by is, you know, I talk to all these different facilities and not just the official channels, but I have fans at facilities that I haven't had on the podcast or people that become fans when I've been to their facility and then we get to know each other. So they tell me stuff behind, you know, like what's going on behind the public view, you know how it is. And
We
have had a lot of those conversations. Yes. And I have this insane perspective now of having talked to people about how things are done at, I don't know, 80, 90, 100 facilities, more once you get into the conservation centers and stuff like that. And it gives me some interesting perspective. And there are some things where, like, I try to be helpful with certain things and I'll reach out to a facility, kind of like the names and quotations type thing. I've talked to some people and they're like, who the heck are you? And I'm like, a guy who has learned what has worked at, you know, 70 other zoos. Maybe not saying I know all, but like, maybe my collective knowledge here is helpful. Like, you know, and if those relationships are built further, like I love the AZA conference. I've gone the last 2 years. I hope to go again this year because you see all these people collaborating and talking and having these discussions. But then a lot of the people that go, the high level people go every year. A lot of the other people go every couple of years, maybe. And the conversations don't really continue that much. Sometimes in the private Facebook group and sometimes in, you know, the listservs and stuff, the boards. I mean, I'm an AZA member. I have all that access, but it's so much, it's such a smaller amount of the conversation than I'd like to see. And yeah, mm-hmm. So I hope that relationship keeps growing. One of my dreams for kind of the zoo industry is that we'll keep realizing that it's global now and it's the internet mm-hmm. matters. And, you know, when you have a group of fandas that is 20,000 people deep on Facebook and you do something that they don't like about one of the red pandas that's popular. And I don't mean bad husbandry. I mean, changing a name or something like that. You're literally hurting your standing with 20,000 people who are willing to make donations and who are willing to share about your facility and who are willing to travel sometimes to see your facility. And I think zoos and the people in them need to stop looking locally as much as they do and realize that it's all one interconnected thing now. You know, the AZA, the ZAA, all that stuff. Have to work together. And there are people who will never even make it to the country that your zoo is in their entire lives who can tell you the name of every animal that lives at your facility, you know, and stuff like that. And that matters. And that has an impact on those people.
Exactly. And as you know, my career has taken me from sanctuaries, AZA zoos, ZAA zoos. I've worked in both private facilities that there are so many voices and things that I've learned from each of these places that if I came in without an openness that I would have missed on something that just was incredibly impactful, and that we have to be open And we also have to understand that the people matter too. And the people being the people working at these facilities, but also the people who are engaging with the facilities, if that's your physical guest or if that's your online presence. We have to think about the connectivity of how we operate. Again, this is kind of where, you know, SSP is almost that mindset of this is kind of what we're doing with the standard. SAFE is getting this community, this type of program idea. How do we then also bridge this with all types of facilities? That when we start breaking things up into groups, putting things in quotation marks, what exclusion, what conversation are we losing when we do that? And what then relationship are we just closing off from? And can we find value in, even if we don't agree, having the conversation to begin with? And I think that that is incredibly valuable, and I do not want to have that be lost. And I'm seeing a lot of positive movement towards this idea, and it makes me really hopeful for a lot of species, for the planet, for the world.
Hope is good. Relationships are good. I feel like that's a good message for Valentine's Day.
Yeah, so have those conversations with people and people that are different from you and people that, you know, have a different experience with animals, even if it's not perfect and empirical. Have it and open it up at least.
Absolutely. I love that. Is there anything else that you wanted to say as we are winding down here?
I want to say thank you, of course, for having me on the podcast. I think this is my third time.
Yes.
Every time I've been from a different point or place and perspective. But it's always great to, you know, have a relationship of conversation and conservation with you and kind of bringing a lot of these ideas into practice just through the conversation that we're having today. So thank you again. Happy Valentine's
Yes,
Day.
Thank you. And happy Valentine's Day. Yay.
And I think the only other thing I wanted to say was kind of on the name thing as well. I was at a facility. It was Two Oceans in South Africa earlier this year, and they had an amazing exhibit of frogs. And the frogs all had their own rescue story and a name. And it was just a little decal. It was super inexpensive to do this type of graphic for them, but it had a picture of the frog. This one was found on the side of the road. This one, you know, was kept as someone's pet in the name. And I watched probably 15 people look at each individual frog, match it to their name, hear their story, then look at the other one and engage with these animals in a way that I've not seen when it's, let me find the frog or what is this? Oh, it's a frog, walk by. That even just the power of, I can identify who this individual is, even if that's the only part of the connection there, is just identifying, you spent longer connecting with that animal than you would have otherwise. And I think that that just watching it in practice gave enough information to me of, you know, just having presence with the animal. Name them. Name every frog.
I love that. Awesome. Cool. Well, thank you so much, Fran.
Thank you.
There it is, folks. Route Safari After Dark. I hope you enjoyed hearing what it's like if you're trying to hook up with a horny porcupine. Okay, I just can't keep this going. Actually, those of you who know me know that I really could, but for all of your sake, I'm not going to. So yeah, hey, I wanted to take a moment to remind y'all that I do have a Patreon and that you can sign up for as little as $3 a month and get access to some pretty exciting bonus content from time to time. I'll be uploading some bonus content for my patrons this week, as a matter of fact. So I hope they enjoy that, and I hope you consider becoming a patron so you can enjoy it as well. And of course, I do want to say thank you to my Red Panda level patrons, Dr. Laura Schenk, Dr. Stephen Williamson, Barbara Bennett, and Jenny Owens. Thank you all so very much.
much. I hope that everyone listening really enjoyed Raw Safari After Dark. We'll be back on Friday with Zoo News. And then next week, we're going to start heading off to another continent for a couple of pretty exciting interviews in the land down under. So I look forward to sharing those with y'all. And until then, remember, friends, the words, sexy credits backwards, are Steiderk Yexus.
The Ross Safari Podcast is produced, hosted, and engineered by John Rossi. Editing and fact-checking by John and Dr. Zoe Rossi. Our theme song is Sevens by Nathan Burke, performed by Nathan and John. Interrupting John theme and additional voices by Taylor Isaac Gray. You can reach John directly on Instagram and Facebook at Ross Safari or by email at rossafaripod@gmail.com. Ross Safari is part of the Daydreamer Media Network. Now, stop listening to me and go visit a zoo.